politics is part of wildlife conservation. It's become part of the North American model of wildlife conservation. It's become a significant part of hunting and fishing opportunities and trapping opportunities in North America, Canada included. And while most of our community, and I think you'd agree, and most of the people that I've spoke with in the last several years, hunters just want to hunt. Fishermen just want to go fish. They don't want to go to the Capitol. They don't want to fight bills. No. They don't want to turn around and deal with citizens' petitions. They don't want to deal with ballot initiatives. But that's why we've been so unsuccessful nationwide historically, is because there's a few organizations and there's a few people that are doing the yeoman's work on the fight, not the conservation and habitat stuff, but the fight. And we've lost significant ground because those major organizations were not constructed 30, 40, 50 years ago to do what we are doing today. They don't start paying attention to the big picture, and they're just segregated in their own little sportsman's club or bow hunting coalition or, you know, fishing membership or whatever. If they don't do what you are trying to help intersect and cross those lines are, who says it's not going to be turkey hunting? Who says it's not going to be whitetail deer hunting? If you look at the measure that we have before us that we'll get into really deeply, it talks about the utilization of dogs, and it talks about the utilization of electronic tracking collars, and they have mentioned in public that we don't want dogs used in any way, shape, or form, and you should not use an electronic device to be able to chase game, period. If we can't rally the troops to get 5 or 10% of all national sportsmen and women, outdoorsmen, hunters and anglers to participate in this, who's gonna do it when they come to, you know, take turkey hunting in Virginia or coon hunting with electronic collars in, you know, Tennessee or Kentucky? If we win, we set the roadmap and the playbook for the next fight. Maybe not here. Maybe it's in New Mexico. Maybe it's in Wyoming. Maybe it's on wolves in Idaho. But we created the network. We created the funding mechanism. We created the outreach and this coalition effort that everybody can go, holy crap, we were part of the success in Colorado and defeating this. Now let's help them defeat something in Wyoming or Idaho or Nevada. And if we're so successful that we can capitalize on, now we move to the next level and let's talk about going strategically offense, proactive instead of reactive. The conservation community needs to express that the overwhelming level of support and success that we provide provides the opportunity for a very small amount of individuals to be successful in their endeavors. You know how many times I've gone out and not killed a pheasant? Everybody. You know how many times I've not decided to pull the trigger on a deer or an elk or an antelope, even though it was in my sights? Why would you do that? Because it's my choice. It wasn't the right situation, or it wasn't a good shot, or it wasn't the right opportunity. Or maybe I just didn't want to pack a 4-point out from where I was actually at, and I was going to try to get something either closer that was of the same size, or I was still hunting for something that I considered to be more mature. That's my choice. Sportsmen and women are not successful on every single level. It's just that we are so infatuated with the outdoors that we go out there repeatedly over and over and over.
Hey guys, welcome to 2024. Thank you for all the years of support. Been at this a long time, and appreciate you sticking with me. And if you're a new listener, thank you for tuning in. If you could help me out by going to iTunes or Spotify and leaving us a review, I really appreciate it. It helps me keep this free. Speaking of keeping this free, check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Use promo code John Stallone to save 20% on everything that they have. And lastly, if you could, do yourself a favor, help protect hunting, help protect your heritage, and get involved with Howl for Wildlife. That's Howl, H-O-W-L, for wildlife.org. Go check it out, get involved. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode. I got Dan Gates on with me, and Dan is pretty much runs everything that has to do with CRWM. I know you got people that work for you, but I'm sure you wear plenty of hats. I'll let you kind of give a quick rundown about who you are and what you do. But
No, I appreciate that. Appreciate the opportunity, John. You and I have spoke on several different occasions, and I've been working with Charles and Mike with Howl, and appreciate all their support and input and participation and engagement as well. As you mentioned, I'm Dan Gates with the Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. I'm the executive director. It's an organization that was formed back in 2017, and we are a 501c4 as far as the tax status is concerned. So it allows us to do some lobbying, advocacy, and education. We don't do in the ground field work or habitat, you know, conservation work. We fight on the habitat conservation side of things and educate on the habitat and conservation side of things. The mission of that organization is to enhance, promote, and defend the North American model of wildlife conservation and responsible wildlife management. That's it. Well, we're not a membership organization. You don't get a magazine. You don't get a free hat. We'll charge you for a hat if you want to buy one. we fundraise for the fight, and that's what we were initially implemented and started for back in 2017. I'm also the president for the Colorado Trappers and Predator Hunters Association, and I've been that since 2014, and I was the vice president for 3 years before that. And I am a lifelong trapper, predator, hunter, wildlife control operator. My son and myself operate a wildlife control human resolution business that I've had for 37 years. So I've got intimate knowledge and expertise on the landscape of dealing with the general public and surrounding wildlife issues. I sit on the newly formed 2-year-old Colorado Wildlife Conservation Project, where I'm the vice chair of that. And that's 25 different national, regional, and state organizations that have come together similar by bylaw status of what the American Wildlife Conservation Partnership on a national level is. We've kind of duplicated that that mentality to try to bring people together on a variety of multiple levels. And I sit on a variety of different governor-appointed, director-appointed boards and committees for Colorado Parks and Wildlife and have for the last 15, 18 years. I will preface that I've never voted for any of the governors that have appointed me. And I think that's a little bit of a badge of honor from a Republican side of a conservation mentality that I can, you know, hold strong and dear that, yeah, I was appointed by these guys. I was confirmed by not so friendly legislative committees. Mm-hmm. And it shows the value that I'm trying to bring to the landscape, because it's, while we are in tough times in Colorado, there's still an opportunity for people to participate and get their voices heard and make sure that they are part of the conversation. As the back of my hats for CRWM says, if you're not sitting at the table, you're on the menu.
Right.
And I honestly believe that. And while I have been frustrated at many, many, many levels of, you know, sitting at the table and wanting to maybe choke somebody out or make sure that they ate my meal as opposed to, you know, worrying about what they were eating on their end, this whole level of what we've gotten into with conservation and wildlife management, it's become political and it's become agenda driven. Mm-hmm. And it's us versus them or them versus us on most levels. And they don't have to be antis. They don't have to be anti-hunters.
Right.
Because the way government funding has happened over the course of the last 20 or 30 years with grants and subsidies and so forth, that's caused more political strife with some of the organizations that we all support, that we're mostly probably all members of, the acronym groups like RMEF and MDF and NWTF and Muley Fanatics and all those groups. Politics is part of wildlife conservation. It's become part of the North American model of wildlife conservation. It's become a significant part of hunting and fishing opportunities and trapping opportunities in North America, Canada included. And while most of our community, and I think you'd agree, and most of the people that I've spoke with in the last several years, hunters just want to hunt. Fishermen just want to go fish. Mm-hmm. They don't want to go to the Capitol. They don't want to fight bills. No. They don't want to turn around and deal with citizens' petitions. They don't want to deal with ballot initiatives. But that's why we've been so unsuccessful nationwide historically, is because there's a few organizations and there's a few people that are doing the yeoman's work on the fight, not the conservation and habitat stuff, but the fight. Mm-hmm. And we've lost significant ground because those major organizations were not constructed 30, 40, 50 years ago to do what we are doing today, right, which is identified by their tax status being a 501c3, where they're a charitable contribution organization, and we are not. We're a C4. If you give me $100 or $1,000 to go to the fight or to go to educate the general public, you can't write that off as a deduction. And while I'm not a tax accountant or a CPA, unless it pertains to your specific business model, you're an outfitter, mm-hmm, and that lion hunting is going to be taken away and we can advocate on your behalf, you might be able to use it as a business expense.
Right.
But if you're a car mechanic, no, and they're going to take lion hunting away and you want to contribute to this cause, it is not tax deductible.
Right.
That's part of the problem that we've run into historically. And I think, you know, Charles with Howe and you guys are finding some of that out. Rocky Mountain Elk and those guys are finding things out about how to better implant ourselves on the landscape and create a broader footprint, a bigger net. And that's exactly what we're trying to do in this measure that we're going to talk about today.
You said something before we get too far along here. You said something about how you are, you know, all on this, all these committees, and, you know, you sit in all these things and you're appointed by a somewhat hunter unfriendly governor and so on and so forth. And I want to point something out there, because I hear this all the time, that people throw their hands up. They're like, well, we're not going to do anything because we're not going to get anywhere because this this governor or this legislator or whatever, they're anti-hunting, and you know, it's just not worth my time. And to me, it speaks volumes, the fact that you are who you are. And if anybody was seeing you in video right now, you are literally the picture, open the encyclopedia up picture of a hunter with that doesn't, you know, follow the very liberal side of things, I guess, you know,
yeah.
How could I put that without being completely offensive?
Yeah. No, you're not going to offend me. I've been a trapper. I've been offended all my life.
Okay. So I need people to realize that. And one of the things that I really want to talk about today that I think, and I've heard you talk many, many times, you and I spoke many, you know, several times on the phone about this stuff. I think there is a very big disconnect in the hunting community when things come up that seemingly don't affect that person directly. And what do I mean by that? I'm a whitetail hunter in Georgia. What the hell do I give a crap about a mountain lion hunter in Colorado? And this is like, you know, this is an ongoing battle that we've had at Howl for Wildlife for many, many, you know, since inception. And it's like, how do you get this person to understand? How do you connect the dots for this person when it's something they're not interested in? Why do I need to get into the fight? Why is this important to me? And I think we, as organizations, we as hunters in general, don't do a good enough job explaining that to the people who don't understand why I should give a crap about you in Colorado and I live in Arizona.
Well, one of the biggest hurdles that I've seen over the course of my life is that we are trying to talk to people that are sometimes anti-hunters. And that conversation is normally not talk. It's more argument than anything. Although I've been able over the course of the last 15 or 18 years to sit down and have a conversation with a lot of people that I would not normally have a conversation with, let alone invite them to my house or, you know, to Thanksgiving dinner or to try to get them to understand my perspective. But that being said, we've also got the middle of the roaders that we have to figure out a way to talk to and educate, which, you know, criticize aside, the acronym organizations that we all support and are members of have done a piss poor job, in my opinion, of talking to that middle of the road potential target audience. Mm-hmm. They talk really good to us on the Sportsman Channel and through the membership, you know, that we all provide, but they don't communicate with the people that are eventually going to make decisions on our part. Then we talk to the hunting and angling and hook and bullet crowd. And so we've got three different audiences that we have to talk to maintain our sustainability levels for advocacy, education, conservation, and so forth. You talk about the guy in Georgia, and I did a social media post, which not until about 6 weeks ago did I ever do any social media posts, and now I've become
Charles has been hammering you with that, huh?
Well, and everybody else too, and it's like, you know, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what button to push and what not to push, because look, I'm a hands-on type of guy. I'm in the field typically, and while I'm astute on emails and everything else, this other stuff is kind of above my pay grade, but the outreach has been so remarkable that I'm starting to figure out how to pay attention to it. But in one of those posts, they got so much traction, several hundred thousand views, is because I got on there and Santino Castellanos did a little video of me and you know Santino and those guys, and it says I'm a sportsman. And I think you saw it.
Yep.
And I say I'm a sportsman first. And one of the problems that we have when we walk into a Parks and Wildlife Commission meeting or any meeting for that matter, and you look at the sign-in sheet and a guy says, I'm a bow hunter and I'm an elk hunter and I'm a deer hunter and I'm a mountain lion hunter. That's what they put on the side, or that's the organization that they represent. Mm-hmm. It automatically divides and segregates us unintentionally just because of our affiliation with an organization or our avocation and endeavor that we like to pursue. And so the guy in Georgia who's never hunted elk or has hunted elk, but is never going to hunt a mountain lion, or maybe is going to hunt a mountain lion, they look at it as a one-off, that it just happens to be in some faraway place that is not going to dramatically adverse effect or benefit me in any way, shape, or form. But if they could consider themselves part of the coalition, part of the army, part of that giant infantry division of sportsmen, mm-hmm. you know, we have Republicans and Democrats that do that all across the country, across the state, across each district, across each county. If sportsmen would do that, we would be more unified. We would be more of a force, not only with our elected officials, but with our adversaries and to the general public, mm-hmm. because we would be a unified group of men and women. I mean, we all contribute to Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson on a federal level, and that money is distributed on a federal level, and it comes from state excise taxes, and it is distributed to state game and fish agencies. The guy in Georgia needs to pay attention to what's going across his county, his state, his contiguous states, his neighboring states, and whatever states that he ever has any inclination to visit or knows that somebody that lives there or visits themselves, because if they don't start paying attention to the big picture and they're just segregated in their own little sportsman's club or bow hunting coalition or, you know, fishing membership or whatever, mm-hmm. if they don't do what you are trying to help intersect and cross those lines are, who says it's not going to be turkey hunting? Who says it's not going to be whitetail deer hunting? If you look at the measure that we have before us that we'll get into really deeply, mm-hmm. it talks about the utilization of dogs and it talks about the utilization of electronic tracking collars, and they have mentioned in public that we don't want dogs used in any way, shape, or form, and you should not use an electronic device to be able to chase game, period. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the guy in Georgia, if he's a quail hunter,
yep,
you better pay attention, because they set a precedent here. They set a statutory precedent as far as what trophy hunting is and the utilization of tools and methods and seasons and species and so forth. It's coming to a state near you no matter what it is. Right. It's not about mountain lions and bobcats here. It's about all forms of wildlife management under that North American model of wildlife conservation and responsible wildlife management.
Yeah. And I look at it like this too. It's like, you know, let's take that same example, the guy in Georgia, you know, let's say you lose mountain lion hunting in Colorado. Okay. Now there's a certain amount of people that only hunt mountain lions. Like that's their thing. Your thing is you're a deer hunter, like you're a diehard whitetail hunter. You know, Joe Schmo in Colorado, that's mountain lion hunting is his thing. Like, so you lose a certain population of that. Okay. So yep. just the loss of that population just took a chunk away from your voice at the conservation table nationally. Okay. It also took a portion of funding away. Okay. So now you don't have those people there. Now you don't have those people buying, you know, mountain lion tags. So the voice gets even smaller and there's less money going back to the conservation efforts or management efforts of, you know, Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Okay. That eventually will translate to less opportunity because one, more mountain lions on the landscape that are unmanaged herd of, or I don't know how you want to put it, or not really a herd, but unmanaged population of mountain lions means there's going to be less ungulates. So there's going to be less tags, less opportunity. Less opportunity means less tags sold, less money, smaller voice, and it just keeps trickling down, trickling down, trickling down. And then, like you were alluding to, it sets precedent for them to come to your state to take away something that you love. And it's hard for people to see that big picture because, like I said, it doesn't seemingly affect that person directly. But if you ever wanted to go to Colorado to, you know, to hunt elk or deer, now that's going to get harder for you to do. And it's like, there's so many different levels and it's, you know, minuscule on the grand scale. Like if you look at it, it's minuscule, but in actuality, it's like death by a million cuts. You're losing so many little things that you don't realize that you're bleeding out. You know, you got all these little cuts yeah. everywhere. You don't know, realize like, ah, yeah, okay, I got this, I got this, I got this, whatever. But I'm bleeding out because there's all these little things that affect me. Even though I don't live there, I don't hunt mountain lions. And that is the biggest thing for me in what I do at Howl for Wildlife and what I, you know, kind of oversee. Like, I want that education out there. I want those people to know that it's important. that what happens somewhere else is important to you because of the way our system, the way that the North American model wildlife conservation works, the way the PR and Dingell Johnson works, but also the way politics work. You know, the stronger our and larger our voice is, you know, the more we can get done. And the smaller it gets and the less relevant you are, let's face it, the old mighty dollar is the biggest influencer of anything, especially when it comes to politics. And the smaller the dollar amount gets, the smaller your voice is. And it sucks. It's a shitty situation, but it's the reality of it. And I think it's important that we understand that. And that's why I want people, like, I'm afraid that people are going to see this podcast and already, I'm going to tell you something. So if I do a podcast about elk hunting tactics or predator calling tactics or something like that, or even a storytelling session, my downloads are, you know, could be anywhere from 5,000 to 15,000. Okay. I do something that's conservation oriented or talking about, you know, I hate to say rights, but hunting and angling rights, those downloads go to like 1,000, 1,500. If I'm lucky, yeah. Sometimes below 1,000, which is mind boggling to me. And that just goes to show me how little people give a shit about what's going on. It's like, it's not interesting to me. I'm like, it's not going to help me kill another deer, but guess what? There won't be deer to kill if it's not there for us to do anymore. If that, you know, and this is the point I've been trying to get across to people. Like, these are the podcasts that everybody should be listening to because it affects everybody. You don't have to be an elk hunter. You don't have to be a lion hunter. You don't have to. It affects everybody. So it should be of interest to everybody to listen, you know? And that's why I want to break down that barrier, and I want to get people to understand that. And I heard you talking about some stuff that was in line with that, like specifically to the language that was in the proposed bill, like trophy hunting and the way that they describe it and how that actually could translate to them being able to take away other stuff other than lion hunting, which then you'd see how quickly everybody will wake up, you know?
Well, and I got to say too, I mean, and to your point, look, I know that, as I mentioned in the first part of my introduction, that politics is not something that people like to mess in with their avocation or their recreation or their enjoyment of opportunity. Whether it's, I mean, look at the NFL for crying out loud. They turn around and brought politics into the NFL, you know, during a lot of different things, including COVID, and their viewership went down substantially. People really wanted to support their teams, but they didn't want to listen to the bullshit at the front of the broadcast. They didn't want to turn around and watch people not stand for the national anthem, or because politics became part of that. This is something to where politics is a major component of this. And I realize that we are not going to get 13.8 million sportsmen and women to contribute to this cause. I realize that we're not going to get 13.8 million sportsmen and women that give a shit about this cause because they don't think that it affects them. But, you know, to the point of who it does affect, as of yesterday, we've taken donations in from 49 states. The only one that we haven't is Hawaii. We're taking in 60 to 80 donations a day on the website and a half a dozen or more through the post office box. And then the industry that has stepped up into this component that has never done this at any level in the least memorable history, the Noslers and the Hornadays and the Quiet Cats and the Yetis and the Stone Glaciers and the Kuyus and the Kafarus and these big organizations, the big conglomerate, publicly traded companies that are like, we have skin in this game. And if Colorado falls for this, we make a lot of money off of Colorado. And we make a lot of money off the Western United States. And if we don't participate from an industry, organization, individual, entity, private landowner, and I'm giving you an example, and then I'm going to read you something that I just got here, then I won't read it the whole thing, but it's on one of the donate pages. But several weeks ago, we got a handwritten, cursive written letter from an alligator trapper and hunter in Florida. He's about 70 years old. He's 10 years older than I. You could tell that he'd never had a computer. But he heard about this through some outdoor life deal that his kid or somebody showed him online. He sent a $250 check and a little handwritten note in cursive that most people could have a hard time reading. And he says, I'm never going to get to Colorado to hunt, and I've never killed an elk, but I hope that when they come to take alligator hunting and trapping away from us, that there is somebody like you to be able to help put up that roadblock and that barrier.
That's awesome.
This guy that just turned around and donated as we speak on this podcast right now, he's out of California. He just sent this deal. He says, first, let me credit this for the donation and awareness of the political turmoil that you were combating in Colorado. And it all goes to Randy Newberg and his Elk Talk podcast for making me aware of the situation. Currently, I reside in Colorado, blah, 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 blah. And he goes into this whole dialogue about who he is. I'm 64 years old and live at sea level, and I am never going to get to Colorado to hunt a high country elk hunt. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, Randy asks that every non-resident hunter send $20 to help fund your media campaign for the upcoming ballot initiative. And assuming many well-intentioned hunters just won't get around to making the donation, please accept $20 for me and the remaining $80 for four other hunters who somehow don't manage to hit the send button. Keep up the good work. It's worth the fight and winning. I appreciate your efforts. This is not a one-off, John. This is something that we have seen, this momentum and this monumental snowball grow of significant importance over the last 60 to 90 days. And we've been fighting this through the title board and the Supreme Court on language and terminology and structure since September 22nd of last year. This has grown to a level that I didn't anticipate. And I'm seeing people reach out to us on a regular basis through our website, SaveTheHuntColorado.com. I got to give those plugs because you're going to hear about 15 times that during this broadcast. But SaveTheHuntColorado.com, and people are emailing us about questions. What can I do to support? What can I do to help? Oh, by the way, I kicked in $50, and I'm going to do another $50 next month and another $50 in the other month. I've had people send $3,000, $5,000 online.
That's huge.
Out of the 63 contributions that we got yesterday that my CPA, who's a board member or treasurer secretary, indicated, 57 of them out of the 63 yesterday were non-residents. Six were in Colorado. Now, we did get stuff in the mail from Colorado residents yesterday. But if you have that sort of an outreach just by the podcast and the celebrity sportsmen and all the industry leaders and people mention it on, you know, Outdoor Life and Field of Stream and Sports of Field and all the magazines, Peterson's Hunting, and it's all coming out. If we can't rally the troops to get 5 or 10% of all national sportsmen and women, outdoorsmen, hunters and anglers to participate in this, who's going to do it when they come to, you know, take turkey hunting in Virginia or hunting with electronic collars in, you know, Tennessee or Kentucky?
Yeah. This is not, you know, to put anybody down on the East Coast, because if you haven't heard my accent, I'm originally from Brooklyn. I feel like guys west of the Mississippi, the western states, we tend to be a little bit more involved in things, and we tend to do a little bit more. I shouldn't say this, because I actually have a lot of people that come from the East Coast that come and hunt with me here in Arizona, but I feel like the out-of-state hunting thing's a little bit more, especially like for elk hunting and mule deer hunting, like you tend to do a little bit more traveling. So people tend to be a little bit more involved in other things that are happening. So I guess what I'm getting at, there's more people on the East Coast that are probably wanting to come elk hunt in Colorado than there is people in the West that want to go to Virginia or Georgia to go shoot a whitetail. I guess that's what I'm kind of getting at. Yeah. So if you have a problem there, and this mindset within the community is not there, it's going to be that much harder for you to win that battle, because you're going to have that many more complacent people that don't want to get involved. So that's like, you know, think about those things. Like, hey, I want to set an example that I was here for you when you needed me. Now I need you. I hope you're going to be there for me. Like, and I think in the years coming, we'll see more of that. Like, I think that's the example that we all need to set for each other. Let's lock arms. Let's be a community. Let's not just be individual hunters in different states and whatnot. So,
well, and I think if we're correct in our assumptions, and this is with our strategy team and our attorneys and the outreach from the industry, like I mentioned, the multiple conversations that Mike and Charles and I've had, and you haven't been part of that only because you haven't been there, but you've been on the periphery of those talks. Mm-hmm. If we're victorious, or should I say when we're victorious on November 5th here, we will set these bastards back substantially because for one, they don't like to lose money. For two, mm-hmm. they don't like to go back to the well and continually lose over and over and over, which we have forced them to do in this state for quite some time. And I'll get into, but if we win, we set the roadmap and the playbook for the next fight. Maybe not here. Maybe it's in New Mexico. Maybe it's in Wyoming. Maybe it's on Wolves in Idaho. Mm-hmm. But we've created the network. We created the funding mechanism. We created the outreach and this coalition effort that everybody can go, holy crap, we were part of the success in Colorado in defeating this. Now let's help them defeat something in Wyoming or Idaho or Nevada. And if we're so successful that we can capitalize on, now we move to the next level and let's talk about going strategically offense, proactive instead of reactive.
Right.
Maybe not in Colorado. Maybe it's a combination of Western states. Maybe it's a coalition of multiple groups that turn around and say, we're tired of having to be reactive and say, where are we going to get the money from? Let's turn around and figure out a way to formulate some sort of a structure that we say, here is the money that we have, as opposed to where we're going to get it from.
Right.
I think there's a monumental movement that I see, and I've been playing in this game hard for the last 20 years. I've done this all of my adult life. I started working at a taxidermy shop at 12 years old, and I grew up around hunting guides and trappers and Western artists and game wardens and taxidermists and fur buyers. And what I learned from that was intestinal fortitude does not happen overnight. Mm-mm. Accidents like what we're seeing from the animal rights community do not happen overnight. But what we have on the North American model of wildlife conservation is not an accident. What we have on sustainable wildlife resources in this country is not an accident. We should act like that we're propping something up to defend it as opposed to squandering around trying to figure out how we're going to run and stop something. Mm-hmm. We should defend it also offensively to make sure that it works. That's the guy in Georgia, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maryland, California. It doesn't matter. If we don't figure out a way to start that mentality and stop the attack here in Colorado and then let that success and that momentum swell out to other parts of the country, maybe it's a segment back east, or maybe it's the Midwest, or maybe it's the West again. Make them come back to us knowing full well that not only are we a grassroots effort, that we are a nationwide grassroots effort, and you are screwing with the wrong bunch because it is our wildlife as much as it is theirs, but we're the ones who protect it. We're the ones who are stewards of it. We're the ones who utilize it. We're the ones that conserve it. And we're doing it so they can have it just as much as what we do. And that goes under the public trust doctrine. That goes under the public trust resource of the North American model.
Absolutely.
We're fighting for what we want so they can still have what they have. They have no alternative. They have no solution. They have no recommendations. Theirs is to take us off the landscape and just let things go back into this rewilding mentality.
Which is
if Georgia crazy. Or New Hampshire or Oklahoma thinks that rewilding is the way to go, there's not much we can do about it. But sportsmen and women know that's not the way to go.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that we hit the field running and that we have the same message, and that's to sustain conservation in this country, because the same message that the antis are doing at us is to take us off the landscape. Yeah. Doesn't matter what method of take, doesn't matter what species or season or structure, take us off. We have to figure out a way to keep us all on. Because one loss, like you said, 1,000 cuts, and we all end up going down the tubes.
Yep, absolutely. You know, and to kind of further take what you were saying. So, I mean, if you look at anti-hunting organizations, I mean, you see their fundraising. Like, you see commercials with the cute kittens and the fuzzy animals and, oh, you can save this and, you know, yada 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 for $19.99 a month or whatever. They all have these people who buy in to their messaging that pay into this large war chest that they constantly have money to do these things to mess with us, so to speak, right? They could pick a fight anywhere because they have the funding. So they're not going to everywhere because they're smart and, you know, they want their money to go as far as it possibly can. So they do their research and, you know, that's why they go for the low-hanging fruit all the time for mountain lions and bears and trapping and the stuff that most hunters are, you know, indifferent about. You know, I'm not a bear hunter. I don't care if you want to bear hunt, but I'm not a bear hunter. So they know where to put the money. But the whole thing is we need to do what they're doing. And I hope that we're able to accomplish what we're setting out to accomplish and get that in place and do exactly what you were just saying. You know, be on the offense or be at the ready, not being necessarily reactive or scrambling to rise to the occasion. Is probably a better way to put it, you know, and we can just simply say, okay, you're going to fight us here. Well, let's direct the resources to that spot and let's take care of that. Whereas, you know, right now, like you're having to do for Colorado, we're having to fundraise just to get to a point that we could put a formidable, you know, opposition against them. Like, cause I don't know, I've heard mixed different numbers but from what I understand, they have like a set aside, like $1 million a week or something like that, that they can pump into propaganda and whatever to reach the middle ground, the voting public. If it does get on the ballot, is that, yeah, correct?
They've got significant deep pockets that have not been unleashed as of yet. I want to go back just real quickly because where we're at in Colorado is something that, you know, happened way back when most people that probably are listening to this weren't even born. Mm-hmm. But in 1992 and 1996, we had two different citizens initiatives that came through. One was the bear initiative to ban the spring bear hunting, to take away hounds and bait. That was in initiative 10. And then subsequently 4 years later in 1996, amendment 14, which is a constitutional amendment to take away trapping, except for the utilization of cage traps, which now they're trying to incorporate that in for bobcats on this initiative. But the trapping initiative was a constitutional amendment that won by a small margin of about 3.5%. And that was to take away the utilization of foothold traps, body gripping devices, and cable restraint devices or snares. You can still use them on private property with the 30-day exemption permit, but it's for human health and safety and livestock protection. We put them at bay from 96 until roughly 2020. And there was an organized effort for an education campaign that came out called the Colorado Wildlife Council through Colorado Parks and Wildlife. And that was sustainable fairly well. And I still sit on that committee. I've been on that council. I've been on there for 7 years and I've been the chair for the last 2.5 years, and I'll finish my chairmanship in February of 25. But that council was created to educate about the benefits of hunting and fishing. It's one of three councils in the country. It's about a $3.2 million budget that is funded by sportsmen and women dollars for $1.50 per license that actually is bought in the state of Colorado.
Nice.
In 2020, the wolf issue came up, and that, you know, not to get too deep into the weeds, because it did pass by a narrow margin of less than 2%. And that has been the divide of a lot of the sportsman agriculture community for urban rural, you know, constructs of what we have to deal with. We just put wolves on the ground, 15 of them, through the ballot initiative, voter initiative. We put those on the ground in December of 23, and then they'll probably end up putting other wolves on the ground in 24, 25, 26, and then probably 27 until they get a sustainable population. That was a voter-driven initiative by the same type of people and some of the same people that are driving this initiative that is trying to take the harvest of mountain lions and bobcats out. Mm-hmm. Where that was actually bringing something in. First time in nationwide history that a voter initiative to introduce or reintroduce, depending on what terminology you use, to bring an endangered species in by the ballot. That in itself sets a precedent nationwide. Oh, yeah. Because you're talking about a federally endangered species that the voters turn around and implemented. The thing that I want to mention, and I don't get a chance to say it often enough, is that as a conservationist and as responsible wildlife management and a steward of the North American model, the Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management didn't necessarily oppose wolves. We opposed wolf introduction through ballot initiative. Mm-hmm. Because there is no management capabilities behind that introduction. There's no hunting structure. There's no legal offtake, even though we got a 10J from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, to allow for lethal control when it's necessary for protection of livestock protection dogs, and human health and safety. But people ask, well, why didn't you oppose this? Well, first and foremost, we were fighting other measures. We had 87 other measures, either in the Colorado legislature, the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission, that our group, CRWM, was actually fighting. Mm-hmm. Not only did we not have the resources, we didn't want to divide and conquer ourselves while other groups were initiating just a wolf deal. They weren't doing anything that we were doing. So in 2019, 20, and 21, we successfully defeated three citizens' petitions the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission to ban the harvest of bobcats. Mm-hmm. And we did that with the governor's appointed commissioners. They didn't like the results of that. The animal rights groups didn't. So they came back in February of 22 with a piece of legislation, Senate Bill 31. Then they added mountain lions to that bobcat deal. Now, you guys helped participate in that pretty wholeheartedly. It was the 3rd of February and 4 below zero, and we put about 350 people at the state capitol.
Yep.
And where we were told we would lose, we won 4-1. So three times we beat them at the commission, one time at the legislature, and then lo and behold, last year they come back with a ballot initiative because they don't like the answers the Democratic elected legislature, the General Assembly provided, and the governor's own personal commissioners provided. Now, these are guys that are supposed to be in line with the animal rights extremist groups that the governor's husband, first gentleman, actually supports and adheres to their beliefs, wishes, wants, and desires. You go through all the processes that you need to go through to cross your T's and dot your I's. You beat them at every single level with their own key players. Mm-hmm. And you provide the facts and the data and the statistics and the science, and they want to go the opposite way and say, doesn't matter what the experts say, doesn't matter what the commissioners say, doesn't matter what the legislature says, we still want to take it away. And now we're going to let the voters of the people of Colorado decide. Well, some of the voters of the people of Colorado are deciding that maybe there's some buyer's remorse on the 2020 wolf introduction because of the debacle that's created over the course of the last 4 years and just now recently getting wolves on the ground. Mm-hmm. We hope that a certain amount of that voter population from then recognizes that maybe it was a mistake and that you should not manage wildlife through ballot box biology.
Right.
We're hopeful that the majority of those people are smart enough now that they become somewhat educated, like what we talked about, educating that middle of the road. The staunch wolf advocates are never going to agree with anything that we say, no matter what. They could kill all the deer and elk on the planet, and they'd still have wolves on the ground, and they would say that they were right. Mm-hmm. The middle of the roader is the one that's going to turn around and make the decision on this lion deal. And what we're asking our community, the stakeholder community, the hook and bullet crowd, is to help us provide a funding mechanism, a conduit, to build up a war chest to where we can talk to that middle of the road group that might have had reservations about what they voted on 4 years ago, or that is starting to understand that ballot box biology is not the way to take care of the public's trust resource of wildlife and conservation. We need that funds from those individuals out there that are on our side, so we can talk to the people that are not necessarily on our side, but they're not on the opposite side either. They don't know, and they need to be informed and educated, because they're not stupid. It's just that they're ignorant about the way the process and procedure in the historical traditions of science-based wildlife management has been implemented over the course of the last 125 to 140 years. And if you can show them the benefits of what they get off of hunting and fishing, about having wildlife on the landscape and knowing that they have sustainable populations and it's managed appropriately, and they get to see deer and elk in the field and maybe a mountain lion or maybe a bear or maybe a wolf or whatever it is, that they can buy a fishing license and go out and take their kids to the nearest park in the Denver city limits. We need to be able to turn around and talk to those people. And our community, John, has not done a very good job of that historically, from organizations down to the sportsmen and women themselves, to be able to get that message out and say, this is why we're here, this is why we got here, and this is where we need to be, and this is how important everything that we do and what we stand for is.
Yeah. And in fact, like how we started off this podcast talking, not only have we not done a good job of speaking to them, we've done such a good job of showing the stuff that is not tasteful with the videos, with the pictures, and with all this other stuff. And, you know, you got guys out there like Matt Ranella that, you know, talks about hunt quietly and stuff. And I don't agree with his philosophy, but what I do agree with is, you know, people tell me all the time, like, oh, you know, what do you want me to do? I want to be able to share my, we've been taking photos since, and we've been doing cave drawings since, you know, of hunters with their harvest.
Yeah.
And well, nowadays I think we need to, if we're going to show the animal dead, you're going to show the grip and grin, you have to do your best to tell the story so that somebody else doesn't write the story for you. You have to be able to share, you know, the camaraderie, the what went into that hunt, how much scouting, how much the meals that came out of it, the, you know, what it means to you, what it meant to your family, not just this vision of the triumphant hunter, you know. And it's hard to do. And I must sound like the biggest hypocrite in the world, because like I said, I had a TV show. I'm an outfitter. I'm constantly faced with this, what's going to sell hunts to when I'm speaking to my direct echo chamber, my direct following. But at the same time, I'm always trying now, or at least in the last couple of years, I've been trying to be more mindful as to what I'm putting out there. You know, I'm not just putting out the one picture of me and the dead animal. I'm trying to post the pack out of the meat and the meal that was made from it. I try to put a caption on there that, you know, is encompassing of what went into that hunt, so people get a better understanding. And listen, I know that's not the end all, but it's a very easy thing for us to do, and I think it's going to speak volumes to those that are in the middle, that, you know, they're okay with hunting, but they don't necessarily want to see blood and gore. And I'm trying to remember, Mark Duda gave some statistics. That I didn't commit the exact numbers to me, but basically it's when the public sees you displaying a dominionistic, I think that's the way you put it, or like showing your domination over the animal. When you portray something like that, it's only received like, well, by like 15% of the population. And then if you're showing, you know, the meals and you're showing more tasteful, like it jumps from like 15 to like 55%. And then if you show like the, whatever the last one was, it's like 80%. So it's like, it's important. It's important for you to kind of put that out there, because you have to be mindful that you're not always speaking to another fellow hunter, I guess. So,
you know, comically, you know, you look at our statistics from a conservation license buying stakeholder group. And in Colorado, for an example, 80%, actually 81% of all lion hunters are unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. They have tag soup at the end of the season.
Sure.
And 91% of all elk hunters in the state of Colorado average to be unsuccessful. Yep. It's a 9% success rate. But those 91% are still paying into the system for conservation efforts and for the opportunity to be able to go. If you listen to testimony from the people that don't want us to do anything, that their acceptable number of pheasants and grouse and bobcats and lions and elk is zero for harvest, well, they would have you believe that you went out and bought a tag and you went out and killed one, and you went and bought another tag and you went out and killed one. Yeah. And then on the third one, because you had so much meat, you went out and killed one and cut the head off of it off and then mounted that on the wall and left the rest of it to rot.
Yep.
The conservation community needs to express that the overwhelming level of support and success that we provide provides the opportunity for a very small amount of individuals to be successful in their endeavors. You know how many times I've gone out and not killed a pheasant? You know how many times I've not decided to pull the trigger on a deer or an elk or an antelope, even though it was in my sights? And I had a conversation with the state director of HSUS several years ago, and she said, why would you do that? And I said, because it's my choice. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the right situation, or it wasn't a good shot, or it wasn't the right opportunity. Or maybe I just didn't want to pack a 4-point out from where I was actually at, and I was going to try to get something either closer that was of the same size, or I was still hunting for something that I considered to be more mature. That's my choice. Sportsmen and women are not successful on every single level. It's just that we are so infatuated with the outdoors that we go out there repeatedly over and over and over. I know a guy that all he does is duck and goose hunt. And there's times after he's harvested a fair amount of ducks and geese throughout the season, he's like, I got so much in the freezer, I don't even shoot any longer, but I sit in the blind and I call them to watch them come in, knowing for the fact that I am still part of the landscape and I am part of the resource. Mm-hmm. And I am part of the structure of stewardship and conservation. Duck hunters do that just as much as bird watchers do that. The difference is duck hunters pay to do that because they have a gun. Their intent would be to harvest whether they choose to or not. A bird watcher has the same interest in the avocations of a hunter, except for maybe their deal is not to go out and harvest, but they don't buy a license to go bird watch. They benefit off the conservation efforts that have been instilled for over a century by the sportsmen and women that are paying for that opportunity so that bird watcher can go 365 days out of the year to do the same thing that the hunter has the opportunity to harvest or not harvest on. But if he wants to go do it, he becomes a bird watcher out of season because he can't take his gun with him.
Right.
Right. They've seen so much activity and so much wildlife resource in the time that they were in the field that they treasure that time. They look forward to the next encounter. They prepare for the next season. I just wish that sportsmen and women would prepare for the fight, for the mission, as much as what they do for the next opportunity to go in the field.
Oh, for
if they would only contribute 2% of what they do to prepare to go in the field, we would be the most undeniably or indefensible organized effort on the planet. If we just gave 2% of what we advocate for, take 2% out of your scouting time, take 2% out of your gun cleaning time or your shooting practice time, and actually go to the Capitol, go to the Parks and Wildlife Commission meetings in this state or any other state that you're at, Game and Fish Commission, write a letter to your legislator. I'm not talking about going to a banquet and a fundraiser and an archery shoot and a shotgun shoot. I'm talking about going to talk to the people or letting them know, the people that make the decisions on your behalf that were either appointed or elected on your behalf. If you spent 2% of your entire time to do that, you'd have a lot more opportunity on the landscape and you wouldn't have to be worried about somebody taking it away as frequently as what they're trying. Mm-hmm. Because we wouldn't have to, because we would have created this juggernaut as opposed to wondering how we're going to create a juggernaut.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I see as the biggest problem in the future is how do we get people involved to participate, to say, you got Sportsman's Day at the Capitol, you got this hearing. I mean, I'm sitting here, John, and I keep getting text messages talking about legislation that was yesterday and what's coming up today in our Capitol. Yeah. CRWM is the only organization in the state that has full-time lobbying representation at the Colorado Capitol on behalf of sportsmen and women. We're it. Yep. Everybody else is a C3. We're a C4. I'm getting stuff. Did you know about this? What's going on? This bill's coming up. They amended this. This one here was tabled. Guys are starting to pay attention, but how much of that has happened in other sectors unless I'm browbeating them and shaming them and belittling them, trying to get them to turn around and pay attention? We just have to turn around and take care of ourselves before we turn around and take care of somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I gave you an example earlier about my podcast, 15,000 15,000 to 1,500. That's a substantial difference, right? You know, and I look at it even my own, and I spend a lot of time, a lot of money in my efforts to protecting hunting and what we have and to get the messaging out and all that stuff. But even that, if I look at it closely enough, maybe now it's probably 50-50. But if I go back 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the time I spent preparing for a hunt to better my skills, to practice shooting, looking at gear and, you know, figuring out how to keep my backpack at a certain weight and all this other stuff that I put so much time and effort into,
yep,
that will mean absolutely nothing if most of this goes away. You know, if I just took, like you said, 2%, 10%, hell, if I took 10%, it's the same thing about when we first were getting the word out about Howlful Wildlife. I went out there and I was like, you know, think about it. We're able, that first year, we were able to win like 30 or 29 out of 30 actions that we were involved in. So whatever it was, yep, we were either able to win or progress in a positive way, 29 out of 30. And we were doing that with, you know, 20,000 people or less And so if you think about it, you know, 14 million hunters, if we had 2 million hunters every time something came up and, you know, got on Alpha Wildlife and did an action, get, and all 2 million of them would, like, we would never lose a damn thing, because they would know, like, hey, there's a lot of people out there, a lot of my constituents, a lot of out-of-state people too, that just, they don't want this. This is not a smart move for me. That's how politics work. You know, the politician's going to do whatever's the best. I'm going to make them look the best, really, you know? But, and I say that tongue in cheek, but it's like, they're doing what they think the population wants, you know, and it's going to, ultimately what's going to keep them in office the longest is if they're doing the most good for the most, for the people that want to, you know, what they want, rather. So,
well, and I think too, and when you get into the political side of stuff, politicians need to be educated, because you can educate them wrong or you can educate them right.
Oh yeah, 100%.
And county commissioners need to be educated. Wildlife commissioners and parks commissioners need to be educated. You can look at, from a historical perspective, of when we've gained successes and when we've had ongoing challenges, and you look at the things that have happened over the course of the last 125 years that I continually mention. If you look at the Lacey Act, the Migratory Bird Act, you get into the Pittman-Robertson Act of 1937 and Dingell Johnson in 1953. You get into other components of the Marine Mammal Act or the Endangered Species Act, things that have benefited and now have been weaponized to some degree. I mean, those are not bad things. It's just parts of them have been interpreted bad. And the thing is, acts have to be supposedly reinstated, because they're acts. They're not pieces of legislation. They are acts. Why haven't we done anything as far as a substantial act outside of land and water conservation stuff or recovering America's wildlife stuff? Why haven't we done anything for hunting and fishing type things over the course of the last 30 years? And I think that we got complacent with mediocrity. Mm-hmm. And while there's a lot of stuff happening on the national landscape, not as monumental as what we've had over the course of the last, you know, 100 or 125 years that we could actually, you know, stick our flag into and say, this is who we are and this is why we do it.
Right.
States could do that. Some states have enacted right to hunt and fish legislation, and we haven't here. It's not a favorable landscape. And even when it was more favorable, you couldn't get the people engaged because they didn't think that they needed to at the time, because they were complacent with mediocrity. Mm-hmm. I foresee and I don't want anybody to take this wrong. It's not like an insurrection at the Capitol. I foresee a revolution coming about conservation, and I foresee a need for hunter-vationist sportsmen and women, hook and bullet crowd, to stand up and plant that flag in a hill and decide what we're going to die on. Mm-hmm. And here in Colorado, because of all the turmoils and trials and tribulations that we've had, this is something that we have rallied around, because they've drawn the line in the concrete that we need to pour new concrete over. It's not a line in the sand that we need to brush out. I say that because we beat them at all of the other mechanisms that are available to us through science-based wildlife management decision-making processes. And they don't like that. They want to turn around and spread their lies and their deceit and play their smoke and mirrors and their shell games with the general public. This is something I think that this community, and now we're seeing regionally and nationally, is willing to die on. It's imperative that we win. It's imperative that everybody else joins forces to help us win. And if for some reason we don't, you will see a revolution start to happen in some capacity when it comes to sporting, angling, hunting type issues around this country. But I don't think that we're going to lose. I think it's 100% solid that we will win based upon what I'm seeing so far, because I really, really believe that in the long run, that good defeats evil and right defeats wrong. And I have to say that, you know, if I'm the tip of the spear on this particular issue and have been for quite some time at other levels, so be it. I'm just hopeful that we can build some sort of a conduit, some sort of a mechanism, some sort of a playbook that we can capitalize on statewide, regionally, and nationally, to where when I'm dead and gone, the alligator trapper and hunter down in Florida can turn around and his kid can say, there's somebody in Florida doing this because of what happened 30 years ago in Colorado. I'm hopeful that the guy in California who's 64 years old, who's never going to turn around and come here and hunt, but sent us $100 saying, give us $80 to four other people that aren't going to contribute $20 a piece, that good is going to help defeat evil and I'm 100% solid with the things that we've got working behind the scenes that I can't really reveal at this point because we're not really into a campaign. Mm-hmm. We're in a proposed campaign because they're still gathering signatures. But I can tell you when this shit hits the fan come July, August, and September, this community in this state and in this region and across this country and through this industry is going to go, holy crap, we are part of a significant change in conservation history because we helped plant that flag in the sand.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on that note, you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but everybody that's listening to this, you know, get involved in this fight. Go to CRWA, go to SaveTheHuntColorado.com. And yep. Right now, it's more important than anything is we need to get the funding in place to have this battle. So let your wallet do the talking here. Get on there, do that. If there's ways that you feel like you want to try to get involved in stuff right now, for me, and I'd have other suggestions, but I think educating yourself on the North American model of conservation, formulating in your head what hunting means to you and how you can have those nuanced conversations with somebody who is a non-hunter and get them to understand your side. I don't want you to be combative. I don't want you to be argumentative. I want you to have a positive message that you can share with somebody to not necessarily convert them, but to have them be an ally if this does make it to the ballot, that when they see this come up, they'll be like, oh, well, you know, I know Joe Smith, he's a good guy, and we kind of talked about this, and, you know, I don't necessarily believe all this crap that I'm seeing on the billboards and TV screen, and I'm going to vote in favor with the hunters. That's my personal message, I think, that people should start doing. I think that's something we need to do as a whole, period, for the betterment of hunting. Dan, if you have anything to add to that or have any suggestions other than, you know, getting involved and going to the website right now.
No, I think I've been asked on multiple levels if there was three things that I would tell people to do to help us prepare for the fight and to help prepare for their fight, no matter what it is. And while I've said before, you know, talk to your congregation, talk to your coworkers, talk to your friends and relatives and your neighbors, talk to your family. One thing that I came up with, and I think that it might have an opportunity to maybe educate some of our own folks about how to talk to some of those, is stand in the mirror. This sounds a little cliche-ish, but stand looking in the mirror, or have your family ask you, why do you hunt? And let you think about why you actually hunt. That would prepare you for a 2-minute soapbox speech of why you do what you do, because then it comes from the heart and it comes from the education that you have. Not everybody knows about the North American model. Not everybody knows about all the rules and regulations. They don't know all about the acts and the government interventions that I've mentioned. I don't expect them to, but I do expect them to be able to answer a question if somebody walks up to them or if they're trying to explain to somebody, why do you hunt? Why do you fish? What do you get out of it? I think if people really thought about that, John, it would be easier for them to explain, just like what you talked about, the meals, the camaraderie, the family get-togethers, the sunsets, yeah. the sun rises, you know, the bull running across the ridge and you not getting the final shot, but that was the biggest bull you've ever seen, and since then you've never killed a bull. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, we have to be able to explain to ourselves so we can explain to others. And so that comes into the part of the education process. And as far as the education process on this particular issue, they can go to SaveTheHuntColorado.com. Hopefully they go there to donate and help contribute to the fight. But there's also a language on there that you can look up the proposed initiatives, Initiative 91, and the one that they withdrew, which is Initiative 101, that we actually were successful on changing language on as well. Both of those are on SaveTheHuntColorado.com. And I think that between now and November 5th, whatever they can do to participate at whatever level, whether it's just being kept up to date on podcasts or outreach and social media or magazine content, because this is a changing and adapting landscape. And I will tell you that the opposition is going to learn off of this.
Oh, yeah.
Whether they win, lose, or draw. they're going to learn off of this, and they're going to plan their attack strategically during the next election cycle that we have to go through. We have a presidential election year this year in 2024. Right. Advertising is expensive because it's presidential. But in 2 years from this November, we have a gubernatorial election. And this has been the most animal extremist governor that we've had in the state of Colorado. And the first gentleman has been the launching pad of that. Mm-hmm. But we will have a major decision to be made here in Colorado in November of 2026, because we will have another governor, a new governor. And if we are successful here at this level, whoever steps into that gubernatorial race is going to recognize that the sportsmen and women, the conservation-minded groups in Colorado, played a significant victory to hold the wolves at bay, no pun intended, but to hold the wolves at bay for the agenda that was launched in Colorado specifically in 2018 when this governor took over. Mm-hmm. Learn about political processes. Learn about what is happening on the landscape, because it's not about Colorado. You have a chance to be able to educate and prepare yourself for your state, for your avocation, for your season of choice or species of choice or method of take. Mm-hmm. You have a chance to watch what is happening in Oregon, Washington, California, New Mexico, Arizona. Colorado is the epicenter. This is not centric to one specific state. And if you think it's not coming to a state near you on something, then you're either uneducated or ill-advised, and you should pay attention, because you can be part of the solution. Don't be part of the problem.
Absolutely. Very well said. Just to put an exclamation point on what you just said, I just got out of a meeting 2 days ago about the possibility of mountain lion hunting bans coming back here to Arizona. So if you don't think it's going to happen, it's going to happen. There's talks about it. There's plenty of organizations here that are here and national that think that Arizona is got the right political climate for that to happen. New Mexico is 100% on the chopping block very soon. I would not be surprised if we don't see something there. You know, if you've been paying attention to how wildlife and all the stuff that's been going on in Oregon and Washington, I mean, you know, California gets a bad rap, but those two states are make California look like you know, the reddest state in the world. But yeah, it's crazy. So it's real important. Guys, Dan, thank you for coming on. And guys, get to Save the Hunt Colorado. Educate yourselves, you know, practice what Dan was saying about figuring out with yourself internally how you would speak to somebody to explain what hunting means to you. It can't always be about the challenge. It can't always be about the adrenaline rush, because those are the things that are, yes, they're part of it. Any hunter would tell you that, any hunter would be lying if they tell you that's not part of it. I mean, it is. I actually wrote a really nice piece called The Hunter's Paradox on my blog that gives you my perspective on it. It might help you guys search your own in reading that. So check that out. And that's it. That's all I got for you.
Appreciate your time. I look forward to talking to you again. Let me know what I can do to be of service.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Hey guys, thanks for checking out the show. Really appreciate you. Keep those reviews and those comments coming. Helps us keep this free. Do me a favor, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Use promo code John Stallone to save 20%, all one word. And check out Howl for Wildlife. Thank you very much, and we'll catch you on the next show.